This is a recording of a seminar held on the 19th of February 2021. It features Ailey Turnbull of the British Institute for Human Rights and Fary Snowden, Director of the Human Rights Consortium Scotland. At this seminar, they trained participants from civil society organisations on the independent review of the Human Rights Act.
So I'm going to talk for about 45 minutes around the Human Rights Act and what do we need to know, especially sort of in this context of a review taking place. And then Mary from the Human Rights Consortium will then speak about sort of the specifics of Scotland and the Human Rights Act and about responding to the review. Okay, so just really quickly, a little bit about us at BIHR for those of you that have never sort of came in contact with us before. So we are an independent human rights charity and we work across the UK and we work in sort of four different areas. We work with people to sort of co-develop and provide people with information on human rights to change their own lives, to use human rights as a tool to create change in their own lives, because we believe that knowledge is power and the most amount of people that have access to sort of accessible information about human rights, the better. We work with communities to tackle social justice issues using human rights, to use human rights as an advocacy tool. And then we also do what's something to see the other side of the coin. We work with public services, with systems, to increase the accountability of public bodies to respect and protect human rights in everything they do every day. So the human rights that we do at BIHR, it's not necessarily about lawyers and courtrooms. Instead, it's about how we can use human rights and, of course, the Human Rights Act as a tool to sort of create positive change in people's lives. And then all that work that we do every day, interacting with people, we then use that to shape our policy work and our policy influencing. That's all about amplifying the voices of people whose human rights are at risk and those with duties to uphold human rights and sort of have them heard and where decisions are being made. Okay, so what am I going to look at today? As I said, Mary's going to come on after me and talk a bit more about how the Human Rights Act works in Scotland and about responding to the review. But what I'm going to look at is really quickly about why we are here today, a bit about what is the Human Rights Act and how does it work in practice? How does it work in everyday, not just in the courtroom? And then what difference does the Human Rights Act make? So last year, in December, the UK government created an independent Human Rights Act review. I'll refer to that as the review this morning. So the review said that they've just launched a call for evidence, and they said it was going to look at 20 years of the Human Rights Act operation. And as you'll hear, I guess, quite a lot this morning, there's some concerns about that because they're asking very sort of narrow and legalistic questions about the Human Rights Act and courts, or the Human Rights Act and government and parliamentary sovereignty and these sort of things, really technical questions that actually miss out how the Human Rights Act had been used every day, which is really what's core of our work and how we can see the Human Rights Act being used people's everyday lives. So the Joint Committee on Human Rights, so that's the UK Parliament Joint Committee on Human Rights, they sort of have recognised this, that there's a big part missing to this review. So they've launched an inquiry into the review. And you can actually respond to both. So if you're responding to the independent review, you can also respond to the Joint Committee on Human Rights review. Just something to flag at the moment is if you are doing that, if you're putting the response into two things, whenever you're responding to the Joint Committee on Human Rights, it's really useful to put in a cover letter, just to say I've also put this response into the independent review. So why we're here today is about refreshing your knowledge on the Human Rights Act, so that you can equip yourself to use it in your everyday life or work, and also to campaign to protect it, not just for this review, but also sort of moving forward as well. Because we've seen from the past sort of 20 years of history that this is not the first time that the Human Rights Act has been reviewed or looked at. There was a commission, the Bill of Rights, a few years ago, for example. So it's really important to think about the future as well, not just this review, but how can we campaign to protect the Human Rights Act in the future as well. Okay, what's so important to do first is to think about what is a Human Rights Act and how does it actually work? Because there is lots of sort of miscommunication and stuff that we hear in the newspapers and so on, which is actually quite different from how the Human Rights Act works every day. So what is the importance of the Human Rights Act? So if we think about human rights and where they came from, the sort of first time that international governments came together and they decided what are human rights, they based them in all those values that you've talked about, equality, dignity, justice. And then they made, as somebody else said, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And that was just after the Second World War. And they had done that because they said, never again will a democratically elected government get to choose who has rights and who does not, who has, who is human and who is not. So it's a minimum legal standards. It's a rule book for how states treat the people that live inside the state. Our Human Rights Act incorporated the European Convention of Human Rights into UK domestic law. I'll come back to that in a moment. And the Human Rights Act is all about the interactions between us as individuals with the state. But the state under the Human Rights Act is all sorts of public services, such as police, social work services, state-funded education, housing, all of these sort of things. But it's also private companies, not-for-profits and charities that are delivering a function of public nature. So it's all about protecting the individual and these relationships with the state, ensuring that we as individuals can expect a sort of basic standard of treatment whenever we are interacting with the state, with public services, and with these private companies, not-for-profits or charities, delivering a function of public nature. What does it mean by this, delivering a function of public nature? If we think about, for example, a private hospital, and some of the care provided in that private hospital is being paid for and arranged by the NHS, then in that sort of relationship, the Human Rights Act would apply, because they are a private company, but they're delivering a function of a public nature. And the past year has shown us that human rights standards must be protected at all times, including and especially during times of emergency. And we've seen the Human Rights Act and the rights within it being used to challenge certain decisions over the past year. Okay, so how do they all fit together? So as I said, human rights, the idea of sort of an internationally agreed human rights document that first came about with the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And that was 1948, just after the Second World War. And then a couple of years later, the Council of Europe came together and they took many of the ideas from the Universal Declaration and they made them into the European Convention of Human Rights. What's really crucial just now is that the Council of Europe is not the EU. They're two different bodies. Council of Europe is much older than the EU and it's more focused on protection of human rights across the Council of Europe. So regardless of what's happened with Brexit, we're still a member of the Council of Europe and the European Convention is still a convention that we have signed and agreed upon in the UK. So that was in 1950. And a really big sort of step forward from the Universal Declaration of Human Rights is that the European Convention of Human Rights had a court system attached, the European Court of Human Rights in Strasbourg in France. And that meant that if anybody in any of the Council of Europe countries felt as though their rights were at risk, they could then take their government, their state to court. So that was a sort of legal accountability for human rights protections. And then if we fast forward 50 years, two big important things happen in terms of protections of human rights. First of all, the Human Rights Act, the law that I'm here to talk about today, that became law. And what the Human Rights Act did was it took the articles, so the rights from the European Convention of Human Rights, and it integrated them into UK domestic law. So Article 2, the right to life of the European Convention, is Article 2 of the Human Rights Act. And then in Scotland, of course, Mary's going to go into this in more detail after me, but we have the additional protection of the Scotland Act, which sets out rules for Scottish ministers, including that they cannot basically pass a law that is incompatible with the rights, with the convention rights, which are, of course, the rights that are in the Human Rights Act and the European Convention of Human Rights. So I wanted to speak really quickly about Human Rights Act and Westminster and democracy, because in the UK media, sort of in general, and partly what this review is looking at is about this interaction about parliamentary sovereignty and the Human Rights Act. So I think it's quite important to quickly address this. So this applies to Westminster, to UK government. The situation is different in devolved nations, and I'll speak a little bit about that in a second, and Mary will go into more detail after me. So how does it work? This is like the idea of separation of powers, government, parliament and the courts. So in terms of the Human Rights Act, the UK government proposes laws and makes a statement saying whether they think the proposal complies with human rights law. This is not legally binding, it's a statement. And then the UK Parliament, of course, they make the laws and they debate any human rights issues with draft laws and can change past laws to make them human rights compliant. And then the courts can review whether laws or the actions of public bodies, either national or local, are complying with the Human Rights Act. So that's really important because a lot of what we hear and from the sort of wording perhaps of the review, you might think that courts are overstepping the map. They have so much control and power over government and parliament. But actually the Human Rights Act was very carefully crafted to sort of make sure that that didn't happen. So the HRA doesn't allow judges to overturn laws made by the UK Parliament. Instead, the High Court, the Court of Appeal or the Supreme Court in a sort of UK setting makes a declaration of incompatibility. And then that remains in force until Parliament approves it, approves change if they do indeed decide to do so. But of course, this situation is different in the devolved nations, including Scotland. So really quickly about devolution in the Human Rights Act, because Mary will speak about the particular situation in Scotland. So the rights in the Human Rights Act, which of course come from the European Convention on Human Rights, apply UK-wide. And public officials in Scotland have the same Human Rights Act duties that I'll talk about in a second as public officials in England, Wales or Northern Ireland, and cases can be brought against public bodies in each nation. So the devolution arrangements in Scotland, that's the Scotland Act, mean that parliaments or assemblies in the devolved nations cannot pass laws which may be incompatible with convention rights, the rights in the Human Rights Act. So that's different from Westminster, where they can pass laws and then there can be a declaration of incompatibility instead, and for example, Scotland, they cannot. And then if a court in the devolved nations finds such a law to be incompatible, it can be disapplied. Again, this is different from Westminster, where parliamentary sovereignty prevails. And it's really crucial, I think, to note that discussions around Human Rights Act, around human rights in general and the Human Rights Acts are different across all four nations. The discussion that I have in Scotland is very different to discussions that are being had in England and the UK wider. In Scotland, of course, moving towards incorporation of different international documents, the international conventions like the Children's Rights Convention. So very different sort of political discussion, political rhetoric, I guess. But it's so crucial. No matter where we are, it's so important that we know our rights and respond to this review, because as some people said, and whenever I ask you to share your views in this review, there's a risk of the sort of rolling backwards, the movement backwards, that we have to make sure doesn't happen as much as we can. Okay, so I'm really going to quickly speak about how our Human Rights Act works. Firstly, the Human Rights Act puts a legal duty on public authorities to respect and protect human rights across their actions, decisions, policies, services and so on. And that is the same across all of the UK. In Scotland, regardless if it's a public authority that's in Scotland or if it's a UK-wide one, it's the people working there, people making decisions there, have to protect and respect human rights across all their actions, decisions, policies and services. The second part is that all other laws should be applied in a way that respects your human rights as far as possible. Now that little illustration is quite a good way to sort of describe how this should work in practice. So imagine that piece of paper behind is any law that a decision maker working for a public authority is using on an everyday basis. It might be a Social Work Scotland Act, Children Scotland Act, whatever it is. So they're using that law on an everyday basis. And the idea is that they have to look at that law through the lens of the Human Rights Act. They can't think about applying their duties or making decisions based on one law and then afterwards thinking, oh, is there a human rights issue? Or completely not thinking about a human rights issue. Instead, they have to think about how can I apply that law in a way that is going to protect and respect people's human rights. That should be the first step, looking through the lens of the Human Rights Act. And then thirdly, a really crucial thing that came in with the Human Rights Act in 1998 is if these first two things are not complied with. So if a public authority has made a decision that doesn't protect and respect your rights, or if laws are not being applied in a way that respects your human rights, you can now bring legal cases in the UK and, of course, Scottish courts and tribunals. And that was an important step forward, because before, people would have to go to Strasbourg in France, and it was very long waiting lists. If you think about it, it's all across all the countries of the Council of Europe, which has over 800 million people living in them, I think. So there's long waiting lists, and it's quite physically expensive and difficult to get there. So now you can bring human rights legal cases in Scottish courts and UK courts more wider. So what does this Human Rights Act legal duty mean for people that are accessing services, or if we as organisations maybe want to campaign to support people that are accessing services? We can speak up, because we all have human rights, which the law said should be respected and protected. We can talk to services about whether they're meeting their legal duty to respect and protect people's human rights, and we can work with services to find better solutions without the need to go to court or use a lawyer. And I think this is so crucial, this is so important. For the past year or so, I've been working on a human rights tool with survivors of domestic abuse. And this is the part that really is incredibly important for them, because it's not about asking for best practice. It's not asking for something additional, which of course can be incredibly difficult to do if you think about the power dynamics between people and services. But instead, it's asking about a legal duty to be upheld. It's not disagreeing with somebody's personal opinion or anything like that, which is incredibly difficult things to do. Instead, it's asking for the law to be upheld. So that can really give people confidence. Using that legal language can really give people additional confidence. Okay, so I'm aware that I'm going through all of this very quickly, but we'll have some time for questions in the end, and we're going to send these slides, and I'll give you links to a lot more information as well. So these are the rights in the Human Rights Act, taken from the European Convention of Human Rights. 16 rights in all. That's them all there. Obviously not going to go into them all today. I could be here for days if I was going to do that. But I'm quickly just going to look at a couple of rights to sort of give you an example. But firstly, I want to talk to you about the framework of absolute and non-absolute rights, because this is really crucial. So absolute human rights, these are ones that can never be restricted, limited, or interfered with, irrespective of the reason, including resources. Any restriction of one of these rights is unlawful, and action needs to take place straight away. So that's things like right to life, right to be free from inhuman degrading treatment. And then the other type of rights are non-absolute rights. These are rights which can be limited or restricted in certain circumstances. If they are going to be limited or restricted, the decision maker has to think about these three things. Firstly, is it lawful? So is there a law that allows this restriction? Is it legitimate? That's for a reason set out in the rights itself, but it's usually around protecting the person at the centre of the decision or others from harm, or protecting the rights of the person at the centre or others, or things around public security, stuff like that. So lawful, legitimate, and then thirdly and crucially, proportionate. This is so important. And this basically boils down to, has the least restrictive option been taken? And are there any alternatives? If the least restrictive option hasn't been taken, if there are alternatives, it's not proportionate. And a decision might be lawful and legitimate, but fall on proportionality. Now, this framework is so important. It's so important for decision makers, because it means that they are taking into account absolute human rights and the fact that they can never be restricted. And it's meaning that they're taking into account if there is any restriction on non-absolute rights, it has to be the least restrictive. But if we flip the coin, and if we think about if we want to challenge a decision, we can also ask the decision maker, is it lawful? What law did you base that on? What's your legitimate reasoning? And again, crucially, is it proportionate? And for example, it's not proportionate because I can think of this much less restrictive way that could have been dealt with. There's this way that would really not impact the rights of the person involved as much, and that's not been looked at or addressed. So that's a massively sort of important practical framework. And that comes, of course, from the Human Rights Act. Okay, so just really quickly about what difference does the Human Rights Act make? So we know, in the work we do every day with people tell me this every day, that it doesn't always feel as though our human rights are protected, especially over the last year. And we also know that expanding on our Human Rights Act could be a really positive thing. It will be a really positive thing. But in order to do that, we need to campaign to keep it, and we need to do that now. So we can't let that rollback happen that somebody referred to. So at BIHR, we believe that the Human Rights Act is, in its current form, an incredibly powerful tool, which has the power to create a culture of respect for human rights in the UK. And we have many examples through our work of this happening, and also of outside of our work as well, of court cases, of campaigning using the Human Rights Act, things like that. I'm going to share a couple of these stories with you today. Hopefully it's going to move on. Okay, so I'm going to quickly look at two rights. The right to respect for private and family life, home and correspondence, and the right not to be tortured or treated in an inhuman, degrading way. So as I said, there's absolute rights, which can never be limited or restricted. The right not to be tortured or treated in an inhuman, degrading way is one of those. And then there's rights which can be, in very limited circumstances, limited or restricted, but must be lawful, legitimate, and crucially proportionate. And that's the right to respect for private and family life, home correspondence is an example of those. So first of all, the right to respect for private and family life. This is a right that covers many things. I usually ask in my sessions, how many rights do you think are in the Human Rights Act? Sometimes people say 400. And I think this is one of the reasons why, because this right covers so many things that are so crucial to us as human beings, I guess. So it protects well-being, so that's physical and mental health. Autonomy, being able to have a say around our life and our rights and our decision making. Somebody also mentioned that whenever I ask what do human rights mean to you, they mean autonomy. It protects participation in the community, relationships with others, and confidentiality. The family life part protects developing ordinary family relations and ongoing contact if split up. And home, unfortunately, is not a right to housing, but it's about enjoyment of your current home. And that could include, and has done in the past, a care home or hospital ward. If you have a connection with that place, if you see it as your home, any decision to remove you or move you on from where you see to be your home is going to impact your right to private and family life, home and correspondence. And then correspondence, of course, that's about having uncensored communications with others. And it includes letters, but also modern communications, text, emails, and so on. So I'm going to share a couple of quick stories with you about this right in action. This is the story of Moira and Emma. Moira is 83 and she lives in residential care. And the current COVID visiting policies at the home mean that no one can visit. And this has been going on for 42 days because of an outbreak. Moira felt very isolated and down and missed her daughter, Emma, who usually visits every day after work. Emma contacted the home and explained that she believes her mum's right to family life, mental and physical well-being are being unlawfully restricted. So this right to private family life here is being impacted. And if there is a restriction on the right to private and family life, it has to be lawful, legitimate and proportionate. And here Moira and Emma want to challenge the proportionality. So she understands that this right can sometimes be restricted, but she thinks that having no contact is not the least restrictive option. So she raises this with the staff at the residential care home, and the staff realise that this is a legal duty and arrange a meeting to agree alternatives that they can put in place to ensure a resident's right to private and family life are upheld. So that's challenging a decision using here the right to private and family life. Is it lawful? Is it legitimate? Is it proportionate? I think it's not proportionate. It's not the least restrictive option here. This is the story of Yolande. And this came from the work that I mentioned I've been doing with survivors of domestic abuse. So Yolande and her kids, they were fleeing domestic abuse. And every time they went somewhere across the UK, they were travelling all across the UK, the ex-partner found them. So they had to move on again. Eventually, they arrived in Glasgow and they were referred to social services. Unfortunately, at this point, social workers told Yolande that the constant moving meant that she was an unfit parent and she had made the family intentionally homeless. So they had no choice but to put the children in foster care. So again, Yolande challenged this decision using the right to private and family life and saying it had failed to respect her own right to family life and, of course, the family life of her children. Again, it wasn't a proportionate response. There was nothing put in place. There was no sort of assessments done to see if the children were at risk or anything like that. And then again, after using this language of human rights, social services reconsidered the issue, taking the family's human rights into account. And they worked with Yolande and her children to find a suitable solution. They all agreed that the family could remain together and social services would help cover some of the essential costs of securing private rented accommodation. And I want to say that at this point, I know that human rights are not a magic wand, and using a human rights argument doesn't work all the time, but it often does. Using that language, basing it in law, saying you as a decision maker working for a public service, you have a legal duty to protect and respect human rights. This is not happening in this circumstance. Either it's an absolute right and the absolute right is at risk, or it's a non-absolute right and your decision wasn't lawful, legitimate, proportionate. So really can create massive change. So the right not to be tortured or treated in an inhuman or degrading way, that's an absolute right. So any treatment that reaches the level of inhuman and degrading treatment is not lawful, has to be challenged, has to be addressed, because any situation which is unlawful, which is inhuman and degrading, is not lawful. So this right protects people from being treated in a way which causes them serious mental or physical harm or humiliates them. This is treatment which can make you feel very frightened or worried, causes you a lot of pain, and makes you feel worthless or hopeless. Now, we talk about the threshold of inhuman and degrading treatment, and that threshold is high. It has to be very serious harm. However, what is inhuman and degrading differs from person to person, and the decision maker must always consider if a decision might impact the person and the people who care for them, and look at different things, thinking about age, health, mental health, capacity, disability, gender, previous trauma, for example, has to think about all these different things. And for example, what might be inhuman degrading for one person might not be inhuman degrading for someone else. So they have to take all these things into consideration. That's why so often blanket policies, blanket bans, stuff like that can be challenged using human rights, because banning visitation for one person might not have a massive impact, but for someone else, it might actually reach the level of inhuman degrading treatment. And of course, the coronavirus crisis might be having an impact on people's situations. Changes to care support networks. Over the past year, so many support networks sort of are not there in the same way as they were previously to people. So these changes could lead to inhuman or degrading treatment, which is never lawful. So this is the story of Muro and Robert. Robert is 79 and he has dementia after having a serious fall at home. The ambulance arrives and his wife Muriel is told that she could not accompany Robert due to coronavirus rules. So Robert was then in intensive care for 12 weeks. During the time, Muriel could not visit and nurses gave her a daily update on the phone. He was then discharged to residential care. The care home he was moved to was locked down the following morning due to a positive test of COVID. It's now been 6 months and the couple have had no contact, as Robert is too distressed to talk on the phone. He's deteriorating both mentally and physically, and the thought that Muriel might not get to say goodbye keeps her awake at night. Muriel reaches out to a human rights organisation who advises her that based on the impact this is having on Muriel and Robert, the couple's rights to be free from inhuman degrading treatment might be at stake. So if you think about the massive impact it's having in their life, it's really, Robert is really making them deteriorate both mentally and physically. And because it's reaching that level, this is not lawful. So Muriel uses a template letter raising the care home's legal duty under the Human Rights Act. And then the care home has since arranged for Muriel to be provided with full PPE so she can visit Robert regularly. And they're looking into testing of certain visitors with Article 3 rights at risk. So again, a big change has been made. Okay, so I'll just stop sharing my slides just now so that Mary can speak. And thank you so much for listening. I'm aware that that was a lot of information to take in. In just over 45 minutes, apologies for being slightly over, but I'll mute myself now.
Clearly, that was brilliant, actually. Always, one of the things I absolutely love about British Institute for Human Rights is that they have fantastic stories, actually, of individuals using human rights, actually, to get change, which is, after all, what so much of it is about. So as Ailey said, I'm just going to talk briefly about the Human Rights Act in practice and use in Scotland. Of course, we are within the UK, so all of the things that Ailey said apply to Scotland, lots of individual things, but there are some specific things about the Human Rights Act in Scotland and the way it works that I think it's useful to look at as well. So I just want to flag up that my laptop suddenly stopped working earlier on. It had a kind of error message. So if that happens again, it just we'll deal with it, but hopefully we're fine. So for those who don't know, I'm Vali Snowden. I'm the director of the Human Rights Consortium Scotland. We're a network of organisations who all want to protect human rights and work together to do that. I am just going to share the screen. Okay. Can you see that? Someone, yeah. Okay, I'm hoping this all works fine. So the Human Rights Act in Scotland is an interesting thing. So human rights, reserved or devolved, for those of you who are in policy geek. And actually what is true is that the Human Rights Act is reserved. So it falls within the basically the remit of Westminster, not the Scottish Parliament. But what is also true is that the Human Rights Act and the European Convention on Human Rights were interwoven into devolution right from the start. So as you know, the Human Rights Act basically incorporates the European Convention on Human Rights into UK law. And right at the beginning of the Scottish Parliament, that was actually in the foundations. It's questionable whether that's why the Scottish Parliament cost so much to build, but basically the Human Rights Act was right in at the beginning of the foundations of devolution. In fact, Nicola Sturgeon just said recently that human rights have been one of the undoubted successes of devolution, which we can maybe discuss another time, but there's no doubt it was right there at the start. So the Scotland Act that set up the Scottish Parliament was passed in 1998, same year as the Human Rights Act, but actually came into force first. And it said that basically any act of the Scottish Parliament is not law if any bit of it is outside the legislative competence of the Parliament. That's slightly legal wording, but we'll go into that in a minute. And is outside that legislative competence if it is not, if it's incompatible with any of the ECHR rights. In short, all Scottish Parliament laws must comply with your ECHR rights, with human rights. So they have to. There's no option. That is basically a big check that all Scottish Parliament laws must comply with the ECHR. The way that that is checked, it's partly checked by the presiding officer and whoever's in charge of the bill. They have to make a statement of competence before any bill is passed. And that must say that it is compatible with the ECHR. Ministers have a duty to fulfil human rights treaty obligations. So in Scotland, we can't sign up to international agreements, we can't ratify them, but they must comply with them, they must implement them. So those are important checks. And importantly, as Ailey mentioned earlier on, it is slightly different in Scotland in that the courts have a strike down power. So because Scottish Parliament laws must comply with the ECHR, ultimately there's a check where courts can say actually that doesn't comply and it is therefore not law. So it's dramatic, and that is a stronger compatibility mechanism than at Westminster, when the courts can say that is not right, it's not compatible, and send it back to Parliament to consider. But in Scotland, the courts can actually say that is not law. Now, of course, I don't know if anyone has nightmares from their driving lesson days, but do you remember the emergency stop? Of course, there is no way that you'd want to use that emergency stop strike down power all the time. But it needs to be there for when it's absolutely essential. So it's only been used a handful of times in Scotland so far, and that is quite right. But it probably has had a big impact in terms of making sure that human rights are taken seriously earlier on in the lawmaking and policymaking process. So has the Human Rights Act had impact in Scotland? Yes. Absolutely. In many, many ways, every day. In many of those individual discussions between people who have the rights and duty bearers who hold the duties on rights. So every day, there are loads of examples very similar to what Ailey was talking about earlier on. To give you a few big ticket ways that has had an impact. So first of all, the Human Rights Act in Scotland has made our justice system fairer. So for example, to give you a few examples, before 2010, suspects in Scotland could be lawfully held for up to 6 hours and interviewed by the police without any right of access to a lawyer. So nobody might know the lawyer, they're not getting legal advice for 6 hours. They could be interviewed by the police. So there was a case taken by someone called Kader, and he successfully argued that breached his rights of fair trial. And as a result, there were reforms introduced to the law that said suspects questioned by the police have the right to access legal advice. Something that I think most of us would have thought was a given, but it wasn't a given until the Human Rights Act was used in court to make sure that it happened. Now, other ways that our justice system have been made better, there's been many cases around making sure evidence is shared with the accused. And there have been a lot of cases around pre-trial delays, but actually justice needs to be timely. So for example, there was a case taken where there was 11 years from when a man was charged to when the trial actually started. And that case was taken, they said, actually that is a breach of his right to a fair trial. So in very practical ways, it's made our justice system better. It has absolutely made our prison conditions better. So before 2005, prisons in Scotland, I mean, they're not great now, but before 2005, they were almost medieval and archaic in their conditions. So people had to manually empty their human waste in the morning when their prison cells were unlocked. So they were using buckets during the night, had to sleep in those conditions, and then empty them in the morning. That was a practice that had been stopped in the rest of the UK and most of Europe long before, but it was still continuing on in Scottish prisons. And we knew that, but there was very little done about it until a case in 2005, which I'm sure many of you will remember, which said that actually that was not acceptable, that it was a breach of Article 3 of the ECHR that is inhuman and degrading conditions. And as a result, the prison service had to invest in updated toilet facilities, something I think most of us would see as a really basic good thing to have. So their justice system, our prisons, and every day actually is protecting most vulnerable people in Scotland. So every day there are many cases, particularly around the right to family life, and for people who were born outside Scotland, who are in the asylum system, who have children here, who have lives here, and it's protecting some of our most vulnerable people every day. I think a key thing has been that the big question has become, does this law or policy or practice measure up to the Human Rights Act? So some of the big impacts in terms of Scotland is, well, does it measure up? The question is not, should human rights be taken into consideration, but how are they being taken into consideration? Then the debate becomes about in what way does this protect human rights or not, not about whether they should be. So the question has changed. I think because of the Human Rights Act. Is the Human Rights Act a foundation to a growing human rights culture? I know that many people in this call, we could discuss this, actually. We could absolutely discuss this. Just a few reflections. In the Parliament now has an Equality and Human Rights Committee, and they held an inquiry into how they could be a guarantor of human rights. It's a really important inquiry. One quote there from the Justice Committee: the committee considers that the scrutiny of human rights issues should not be viewed as box-ticking exercise, but as something fundamental to all the work it undertakes. So maybe there's a growing human rights culture in the Parliament, of which the Human Rights Act is the foundation. A growing human rights culture in public authorities. Without a doubt, there is definitely more awareness of human rights. It's nowhere near what it needs to be, but we see the beginnings of specific ways in which public authorities are taking into account human rights in their strategic plans. So, for example, the Prisons Inspectorate has guidelines which take an explicitly human rights-based approach. To give you a specific example, the police in Scotland were carrying out unlawful stop and search back in about 2010, 2011. interesting because if you'd asked me, I would have said the Met in London used stop and search the most. Back in 2011, actually, it was the police in Scotland who used stop and search the most, and it was unlawful. And so, give you a quote from the Scottish Human Rights Commission. In recent discussions with Police Scotland, the Commission stressed the importance of putting measures in place now to preempt any future legal challenge to use stop and search. In our view, such a challenge would be likely to succeed, given that everyone's right to privacy is protected by the Human Rights Act and by the ECHR. A very kind of practical example of, because there is the risk of court action, and Police Scotland then took proactive steps to address the concern and to make sure their use of stop and search is lawful. So that's just to give you a few examples. Has it helped as a foundation towards a growing human rights culture across Scottish society and the public? We could discuss that, but there's certainly growing awareness of human rights and people talk about them more. For discussion. And I know that many of you have been involved in discussions around this already, but as you know, the Human Rights Act therefore incorporates the ECHR, which is Civil and Political Rights. And in Scotland right now, there are massive developments going on to incorporate all of our international human rights into Scots law. That is the absolute direction of travel, and it is a hugely exciting and ambitious one. So at the moment, there's a bill in the Scottish Parliament to incorporate the UNCRC on children's rights. It's almost passed. I think it's got 1 month to get through. And there is a national task force on human rights, which, again, many of you know, is looking at incorporation of economic, social and cultural rights. So that's things like the right to food, the right to housing, the right to health, the right to education. And so looking at incorporating the right a healthy environment and treaties for specific groups. So the direction of travel is forwards and stronger human rights law in Scotland. The key questions for me are, we need to keep going forwards on human rights and not backwards. So one of the concerns of this Human Rights Act review is the risk of going backwards, and that's just not the direction that we want to be in. We want to go forwards. And I think there are two big concerns, these are just my reflections. Is that concern about rights regression, particularly at a UK level? We've already seen that in Brexit, that we have lost fundamental legal rights protections. So, and there's a concern about this Human Rights Act review. So the big concerns on rights regression, and the concern in Scotland is that we have brilliant rhetoric often on human rights, but it's making that a reality. So as Ailey said, the review is ongoing. I'm just going to flag up a few ways that you can respond to that. As Ailey said, the review asks very narrow questions. It's very specific, it's very legal and sort of techie. And it doesn't reflect 20 years of Human Rights Act in operation protecting individuals, many of whom are very vulnerable. So it's a very powerful, practical tool. And with particular concerns about messing with the rights progression in Scotland. So if the Human Rights Act is meddled with, that could impact the progression in terms of rights in Scotland, and that's very concerning. So there's an opportunity to have your say. So as Ailey said, there's a couple of guides you can look at if you want to respond. So there's one from the VIHR and we've just produced a guide between the Consortium and Just Right Scotland around for organisations in Scotland on some of the specifics that you might want to respond to. Secondly there, think about examples. It's always the examples that hit home with everyone, whoever you're trying to influence. It might not be examples of court, that's not what it's about. There might be examples of how you've used the Human Rights Act in policy or in advocating for people or in individual decisions. If you have questions, there's a link there that you can send your questions to VIHR, or by all means just get in touch, our email address there. And the deadline for the response to the review is the 3rd of March. Now you might think there's no way I'm going to have time to respond wholly to review, that's fine. So VIHR are collecting views through that SurveyMonkey survey. From the consortium point of view, we'll be doing a joint submission and looking for organisations to sign up to support that. So you can get involved in that. And there's also lots of resources on the VIHR page. And actually, I should say there as well, on the consortium page, you'll see some resources there around the human rights. After the 3rd of March, so that's only, 3 weeks away, there's still things you can do. So, as Ailey said, there's also the Joint Committee on Human Rights, which is at Westminster, is holding an inquiry too. You can send some evidence to them. You can be vocal on support for human rights strengthening in Scotland. The task force is due to report on its recommendations in March. What could you do to add your voice and your weight to saying, actually, we want all of our international human rights in Scots law? We want the direction of travel to be forwards and not backwards. If you're not a member of the Human Rights Consortium, please do join up. It's free, it's easy, and it means that we can work together on all of this. And as Ailey said before, obviously social media is useful. You can follow BIHR or the consortium there.